Welcome to the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week. I'm your host, Hank Sanders. Each week, we tackle a different issue that's uniquely Portland. So tune in every Saturday to hear a new episode complete with interviews and editorial that helps explain our city. From Portland's leading paper comes a brand new way to engage with the news, sports, arts, and culture. Stick around. Welcome back to the Dive Podcast. This is episode 10 of our show. Thank you so much for supporting us and listening to our show week in, week out. I'm your host, Hank Sanders. Today is March 6th. Yeah, first episode in March. Feeling good, feeling excited, ready to go. We have a great show for you guys. We have an interview with Willamette Week reporter Tess Risky. We talk about the violence surrounding Portland's legal weed industry. We end our show with Quote of the Week. All that and more coming up next. But first, 90-second news flash. Folks, shame on me because I fear I have jinxed us. Last week, I came on and ran my mouth about how COVID numbers in Portland had been declining for several weeks straight. Things were looking great, but that all changed when the last week in February, we were so close, but cases started to increase. So during that week, we had 2,600 new cases with 57 deaths in the last week of February, which was a 17% increase from the week before. And experts are warning of yet another surge. The vice president and general manager for Nike North America resigned on Monday, and Hebert stepped down after a Bloomberg Businessweek article was published about her son's shoe resale business, which raised concerns about there being an inside connection at Nike with this business. The company was run on Ann Hebert's credit card. If you listen to the show, you know that Representative Diego Hernandez has stepped down from his seat in the Oregon House due to sexual harassment claims. Four people are now vying to replace him on his seat, which will be vacated on March 15th. The Multnomah County Commission will pick someone to fill his seat, with the deadline being 30 days after March 15th. The Grilled Cheese Grill is closing permanently, which shouldn't bother me considering I'm very lactose intolerant, but it actually really makes me very sad because their sandwiches were well worth the stomach ache. Folks, this has been 90 Second News Flash. Our interview of the week covers the reporting done by Tess Risky. Despite weed being a legal product in Oregon for 5 years now, weed stores are the most robbed stores in the state, with an average 2 armed robberies a week. Earlier this year, a weed store employee was killed during an armed robbery, setting up a firestorm of debate about how to protect stores and their employees. What follows is a deep dive into the issue with my interview with Tess Risky. I began having a lot of questions about the weed industry as I was reading this article. And one of them was probably the most obvious one to most readers. And it's that this product is legal, but weed companies have been, like you said, have been broken in and robbed more than any other single type of business. So you're not going and stealing liquor from a liquor store, but you're stealing from a weed store. What makes weed stores an easy hit or such a target?
Well, there's a few different reasons for that. So this all stems from the fact that cannabis is a Schedule I drug federally. So it's illegal on a federal level, which means that in the states where it is legal, there's sort of just a patchwork of different regulations relating to cannabis. But the major impact of the federal illegality is that cannabis businesses don't have access to banking, because then the banks themselves would be subjected to federal prosecution potentially. So the result of that is that these shops have to have a lot of cash on hand. Separately, you know, cannabis itself is really valuable. So, you know, one jar, depending on the size and how many ounces of cannabis are in it, can sell retail value for, you know, $500 to $1,500. And that value only increases when you take that across the border to Idaho, for example, or other states where it's not legal on a state level.
I wanted to ask a follow-up about what you just said there about the value of weed, the street value of weed. And that was another question I had when I was thinking about this legal industry. There's no street value for whiskey. There's no street value for things that are legal for people 21 and over, such as alcohol. Why is there a street value to weed? Is it just because some places it isn't legal, like you said, across state lines?
Yeah, the fact that it's federally illegal is what creates this illicit marketplace, or, you know, a black market, so to speak. So people who live in states where cannabis is not legal on state level, they still have access to it in other ways, right? Like, it's not like cannabis doesn't exist in the state. And one of the main ways that that drug gets to different states is that, you know, it's taken from places like Oregon, where it is legal.
When you were writing this and you're looking at some of the problems that come when you legalize things state by state and not just federally, were you thinking either A, we have to legalize weed federally as a nation, or were you thinking we should never have legalized this? We open up a whole new can of worms and people are literally dying because it's legal.
I think, you know, based on my reporting and the people I've been speaking to, it makes the most sense for cannabis to just be legal federally across the board, because that way it can be, you know, regulated by the state and the federal government. The bottom line is that the federal illegality of cannabis makes the industry very expensive for retailers in places like Oregon. Cannabis retailers have all of these additional fees that normal businesses do not have to pay. It makes it difficult for them to afford security measures that could actually help make it safer. So that means it makes it hard to pay for a security guard to be in the store, for example. It makes it hard to upgrade all of your cameras. Maybe that means you can't afford to put, you know, metal bars on your windows.
So weed companies are raking it in. They're making millions and millions of dollars for the state, and it's a massive industry where you see celebrities and massive banks investing heavily in the legal weed, in legal weed companies. One of the biggest IPOs in Oregon's history was with a weed company a couple of years ago. So they're making so much money, but they don't have enough money to pay for security.
They are making a killing in one sense, but they have to pay so much in taxes and premiums for insurance and banking fees that, at least to the retailers I spoke to, it doesn't really feel like, you know, they're raking in the cash despite record sales during the pandemic.
Yeah. And then I think maybe another thing, and correct me if I want to know your opinion on this. Sometimes banks won't have security guards at their on site because the average bank robbery only nets the robber, you know, $1,500, whereas a security guard is a six-figure fee for the bank. So maybe is it a little bit of a cost-benefit analysis where they're like, either we could shell out for this person, or we could just hope that we get robbed only once a year and we're actually netting a profit?
I haven't met a cannabis store owner who doesn't want a security guard. The only reason they don't have one is because they're expensive.
Right. On the web edition of the cover story, you have a link to a video of one of the weed stores getting robbed. It's an insane video to watch. People just go in at gunpoint and are in less than 3 minutes, they have $16,000. And without sounding too crude, it makes it seem incredibly easy to rob a weed store, which, you know, you made it seem that way as well in the story, with police not responding to calls and a lot of things like that. Yeah. If this is legal federally, does that all go away, or does that stay? Because at the end of the day, you're selling drugs.
I don't think that passing the Safe Banking Act would eliminate all crime completely against these cannabis stores, because, you know, they still would have drugs on hand that are valuable, but it would significantly reduce the amount of cash they have, which is a huge allure to people who want to rob or burglarize these stores. And then the argument of, you know, if it's legalized federally, there is not this illicit marketplace anymore.
I really want to know about the idea, and it's more than a theory because a lot of people have said this in the article, that the police don't really care about these crimes. They don't they come 20 minutes after the ambulance comes. Why is that? Because it seems to me that they would love to deal with these people.
Well, there is a perception in the industry that the cops view them as, you know, drug dealers, despite the fact that, yes, weed is legal in Oregon. And some of them have expressed to me that they think the cops feel like, well, you know, if you're going to be dealing in drugs, you're going to have to expect crime to come along with that. Cannabis shop owners I spoke to feel like the police almost have a bias towards them, and not like they are actively against cannabis shops, but that they just don't feel as inclined to prioritize investigating those cases. But there's a lot of other arguments too. The police's robbery unit, all six of those detectives were reassigned since late May up until Thanksgiving to covering protests in Portland. And they were not actively able to investigate robberies during that period. So that also lands after, you know, a $15 million budget cut to the police bureau in June, and an exodus of more than 100 police officers in the last year. You know, the protests being having their budget reduced, all of that. But then the cannabis store owners come back and they say, well, because you guys have been constantly broadcasting that you are so overwhelmed, you've essentially given a green light to this criminal enterprise. And you've told them, hey, we can't respond to crimes quickly. All of our detectives are off doing other things right now. So if you want to go rob a cannabis shop, you know, have at it, because the cops aren't going to be able to do anything.
That's really interesting, because not only does it seem like maybe if they legalized it, this isn't just a Portland issue, where if they legalized it federally, cops might still have that idea about weed stores being drug dealers and not come as quickly, but also just the idea that, Portland really was, I went to some of those protests and all of them that I went to were peaceful, but people were screaming defund the police. And that comes with, you know, changing how much the police can respond to these kinds of calls. So that's really fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, what's really interesting to me is that this topic is very progressive at heart, where legalizing marijuana at a large for a state is a progressive idea. And yet at the heart of it are these other two issues. One of them is gun control, and one of them is the policing. So two very catchy topics for among progressives recently have been defund the police and also to restrict, to limit the amount of guns that people can have, controlling people's guns. And yet here we have the problems when the police force might be stretched too thin. And we also have the problems when people can just have guns, both as robbers, but also, like you were talking about, now they're asking employees of weed stores to carry guns on them. Yeah. So can you talk to me a little bit about how these issues are colliding, where weed stores are now dealing with gun control laws and defund the police laws and other things that have been very hot topics recently?
Yeah, I think sort of what you're getting at is that cannabis shops feel like they have to take matters into their own hands. You know, if they're going to be constantly burglarized and robbed, and if the police aren't going to be able to respond quickly, then some of them who I've spoken to said, I need my employees to be armed.
What was the hardest part about this story? What was the hardest part reporting about this story?
Well, I think at first, when I just had the raw numbers of the amount of incidents, it kind of seemed really clinical, like, oh, wow, you know, 100 plus robberies, burglaries, and break-ins in a year, like, that's a lot. Wow. And then just when I actually unpacked that and started contacting the people affected by those incidents and, you know, met with Gina, who owns Cured Green, and learned more about Michael Arthur, who was murdered in December, and watched, you know, surveillance footage from a few of these stores. It just became, you know, I became acutely aware of how painful this is for the industry.
it takes a toll for sure.
Yeah, it was very painful to hear all of these stories.
In this story, there are a bunch of tactics that weed store owners took to prevent themselves from being robbed, and it seemed like none of them worked. Safes, where only one person knew the combination, didn't work. ID scans, where you can't go in the store directly, you have to have your ID scanned, result in somebody dying. Mm-hmm. Bars on windows didn't work. Is the only thing that's going to work what we talked about earlier, and the only way to do that is to legalize it federally? Is that the only way forward to prevent two robberies a week at these stores?
That is probably the most tangible or like pragmatic way forward. But that still is in a lot of ways a band-aid solution, because at the end of the day, you still have a lot of young people, at least in Portland. Many of the people who've been charged so far are teenagers. Seven of them are minors. A lot of them are still in high school or were at the time of the robbery, who feel, you know, inclined to rob a store at gunpoint, or who feel like a few jars of weed and a tip jar with less than $20 is a fair exchange for murdering somebody, which is what they took after they killed Michael Arthur. So what I'm getting at is that I don't get the sense from speaking to all of these retailers that, you know, you can legislate away these root issues societally that lead to crime, you know, whether that be, you know, poverty, or, you know, some people have suggested it's boredom among teenagers who, you know, are doing school at home during the pandemic. You know, whatever the reasons are that lead to somebody to feel like robbing someone at gunpoint is their best option,
right. That
isn't something that, you know, the Safe Banking Act is going to cure. It's one element forward and probably like the most pragmatic in the immediate future, but the underlying issues will still be there.
Yeah. And the person who killed Mr. Arthur has never been found, right?
Not yet. The last time we checked with the police bureau, they hadn't identified a suspect. That's an important issue I want to talk about too. So one of the reasons why these retailers feel less safe, specifically during the pandemic, is it's pretty simple, but it's because people are wearing masks. So it's pretty hard to identify somebody who's wearing a mask, even if you have great security cameras. So that's a big element to this too, is that the faces of a lot of these suspects are very obscured in the footage.
So it's like we can legalize it federally as long as we ban people from wearing masks, allow anyone to carry a gun, and fund the police more. Anyways, what was something that got left out of the article?
There was a lot that got left out of the article though. Like if I could have had it my way, this story would be like twice the length, but that's not how it gets to be.
So this was a story that you were like super interested in. You were kind of gripped by this one.
Yeah, I was. I think I've always been really fascinated by the cannabis industry. I was a high schooler in Washington State in, you know, about, 2012 when they legalized cannabis there. And so I've always just been interested in sort of like the impacts of that. And I also remember too, when I was a sophomore in high school, that two of my classmates who were teenagers were arrested for an armed robbery of a cannabis shop, and they zip tied the employees. I remember this pretty vividly happening because they were both, one of them was in my math class and the other, he was just around. And I remember they both went to prison for a long time. And that just like, that was the first time I had known somebody personally who went to prison. And I remember, and unfortunately, one of the guys after he got out was later killed during a different break-in. So anyway, what I'm getting at is that I think that just kind of that memory started to come up when I was reporting this, of those two kids who I knew, and they were like my classmates, one who sat near me in math, you know, and they're just regular kids.
So this story is framed around the death of a man named Michael Arthur, who worked at a weed store that was robbed and was shot for what seems to be pretty much no reason. He was complying with the people who had guns and was just shot. And his people who shot him have not they have no leads on who these people were. Talk to me a little about your interaction with his good friend and two people. First, his good friend who ran the store, but also his fiance, his girlfriend at the time, girlfriend at the time, mm-hmm. And who remarked on how good of a dad he was. So talk about that experience.
So the owner of Cured Green, her name is Gina Yu. She met Michael about 4 to 5 years ago when he was just a customer in the store. And she says that all of her employees are previous customers. Like, she gets to know people in the neighborhood who come into her store, and eventually, you know, one thing leads to another. And if she has an opening and they need a job, she hires them. So that was the case with Michael Arthur. They had been friends for a couple of years, and he had been working in homeless services. And, you know, Gina says he was just feeling really disillusioned by, you know, the work and feeling like a little frustrated at not being able to make a difference. So, you know, she offered him a job in her store. And the two of them started working together about 5 days a week, you know, side by side. And one of the few times that they didn't is that Monday when Michael died and Gina was undergoing like a screening for breast cancer of some sort. And she remembers being like texting him saying, "Sorry, I'm not with you. Like, we're always together, blah, blah, blah." And, you know, he was like, "Oh, don't worry about it. We're fine." And then that happens to be the same day where he was murdered. And also spend time with Michael Arthur's girlfriend, Kiara, who's quoted in the story. They both just described Michael as being a very, you know, energetic and humorous guy, a loving father, you know, just like a Portlander. I don't know how else to describe him, but it felt like what happened between Gina and Michael was just like a quintessentially Portland friendship of these two, you know, strangers meeting in a pot shop. And I think a lot of people are wondering, like, how could this have been prevented? And it's hard because you kind of come up empty-handed for an answer. Grateful for the little things I love. Early morning light and you. Don't think about the goodbye stuff. Remember someday might come soon. Some days when I wanna hold your hand, I wonder if you're dreaming.
Folks, now it's time for Quote of the Week. This week's quote comes from Portland Public Schools history books. A parent raised concern about the books her 12-year-old daughter was reading. The books say a variety of things, including, quote, "To run a plantation well, you need to be intelligent and industrious. A plantation owner is like a business executive. He is responsible for the work and the workers." The book also calls Jefferson Davis, who was the president of the Confederate States, a, quote, "model slave owner," unquote. And as you can expect, the response from PPS and school and teacher was, "Thank you so much for bringing this to our attention. These are troubling quotes. We will stop using the textbook immediately." No, that was not the response at all. The response is much more like, "Hey, pound sand. We're going to continue using this book. Your daughter can skip class if she would like, but this is the book we're using." And folks, those are just bad quotes. Usually quote of the week is like, "Oh, look how silly that person is for saying that." And I take things out of context and probably undermine my own credibility in doing this. But hey, those quotes right there are just not good. Not good at all. Folks, thank you so much for listening to the show. This has been episode 10 of the Dive Podcast. Catch us next week for another great episode. Who knows? Maybe we'll have even more fun than this week. Folks, I just thank you so much for coming on and listening, and have a great rest of your weekend. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week. For more information on this podcast or the biggest stories in Portland, go to wweek.com and follow Willamette Week on all socials. We're doing some really cool things related to the podcast on our Instagram and Twitter. Includes giveaways, behind the scenes, etc. A lot of cool things coming your way, so give those a follow. Special thanks to our guests for joining us, and thank you to Aaron Mesh, Mark Zussman, and Brian Panganibon, as well as the entire Willamette Week family. For Willamette Week, I'm Hank Sanders. This has been the Dive Podcast.